Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Marsis, and today on this New Year's holiday, we'll examine the important domestic political issues and social trends in 2014 and look ahead to what might emerge in 2015. Stephen Schwartz, a research associate of cognitive sciences at the Laboratories for Fundamental Research and the editor of the daily web publication SchwartzReport.net, where he identifies and analyzes trends that are affecting the future, joins us to discuss the red-blue political divide in the country that was glaringly apparent in the last election. With Republicans dominating rural America and Democrats concentrated in urban America, we will look ahead to a possible devolution of power to the states as the more successful blue states like California and New York tire of subsidizing the red states in the South. We will look ahead as our divided country heads in different directions, with the blue states moving into the 21st century, embracing progressive social change and economic innovation, while the red states move back to the 19th century in economic terms and the 17th century in social values. We'll also explore the growing disgust with our politics as fewer Americans vote, while record amounts of money are spent on campaigns, and the growing scandal of income inequality, which is likely to get worse for younger Americans saddled with student debt before they even get to the job market, which is being steadily downsized to accommodate what the 1% claim is the necessary result of global competition. And joining us now on this New Year's holiday is Stephen Schwartz, a distinguished consulting faculty at Saybrook University and a research associate of cognitive sciences at the Laboratories for Fundamental Research and the editor of the daily web publication SchwartzReport.net, where he identifies and analyzes trends that are affecting the future. His work has appeared in The Washington Post, Smithsonian, American Heritage, American History, Omni, Harper's, and Explore. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Schwartz.
How are you, Ian? And Happy New Year to you.
And Happy New Year to you. And let's take this occasion, which many people in the media are doing. They're looking back at 2014 and ahead at 2015. Let's look ahead at 2015 in terms of the challenges that the country faces on the domestic front. Tomorrow we'll have the foreign policy front, but let's focus on domestic politics. How do you see this divided country going forward in 2015, particularly where the division is so stark between a Republican Congress and a Democratic White House?
Well, I think the division is going to become exacerbated, is going to become even stronger. And if you look at the social outcome data, if you think of the states each as sort of experimental laboratories, I mean, just take California and Kansas, for instance. Jerry Brown inherited a state in financial collapse with all kinds of problems. And Sam Brownback inherited a state with a stable economy and a long tradition of sort of moderate conservatism. And what you have now is a California in which there is a surplus and there are a number of exciting things happening. And in Kansas, it's falling apart because both Brown and Brownback have each pursued a political vision and social policies, the one compassionate and life-affirming to a greater degree, and the other essentially designed to support an elite, and you can see the results.
Well, it's also, I think, the results when ideology completely overtakes any kind of pragmatism.
Yeah, I mean, if you make social policy on the basis of facts, if your social policies are designed to produce wellness and are fact-based, then you make choices that create wellness, that you support social welfare systems, you try to create a world in which normal people can have a decent quality of life, you try to reduce wealth inequity, and if you are following a ideological non-fact-based system, then you do what's going on in the red value states, and you can see the social outcomes. I mean, just pick one thing. A child in Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana is four times more likely to be abused physically to the point of hospitalization than a child in Vermont. And there are hundreds of these kinds of statistics.
So what then is the explanation for why so many Americans, for example, on the one hand, on the political left didn't vote in the last election, and on the political right did vote almost en masse and got their majority? And of course, the first thing that they did, even before the new Congress, was give a giveaway to Wall Street, which was actually inserted as a rider in the bill. Literally, Citibank and Jamie Dimon dictated to the Republican congressman, and they got this flagrant quid pro quo where Wall Street gamblers can get the FDIC to back swaps and derivatives. And that's exactly what happened in 2008. I'm talking about how short our memories are. And in exchange for this, the ceiling was raised on direct contributions to parties from 32,400 to 324,000. So it's inescapable not to see a connection there, that this was a transaction. You know, you give us what we want, and then you allow us to give you more money.
Well, I mean, the truth of the matter is that they don't even bother to put a merkin on it anymore. No, it's completely blatant, because it's the level of corruption that is going on in the United States. I mean, it's not absent Spiro Agnew getting bags of cash. I mean, it's not, you know, somebody going in and handing you a bag of cash. It's the quid pro quo is just exactly as you cited it. But the truth is that as a result of Citizens United and other Supreme Court decisions, we are now flooded with basically limitless money. The thing that the general media, the corporate media, doesn't talk about, you know, you hear people write about or say things on television about the Koch brothers spent $200 million. What they don't tell you is that the best economic analysis we have tells us that for that $200 million, they're going to get $19 billion of additional profit. So if I told you if you'll spend $200 million, you'll get $19 billion back, I mean, you'd spend it in a minute.
Well, that's been going on for the longest time. The government is rather than in a social democracy where the money is recycled through taxes, where citizens pay their taxes and get their services, we have become less and less a government that responds to its citizens and more a government that responds to its funders.
Yes.
And that is the—
Yeah, that's correct.
That is the so clearly the case. And, you know, for the longest time, for example, you can put a little rider in a bill to extend the patent on a drug for a company, and that drug company will pay the senator maybe, you know, $10,000. And that additional extension of the life of that drug before it becomes a generic could yield that company several billion.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
So you're right in pointing out that there's no there's no more money in the politics than anywhere else. I mean, this is the greatest profit scam in the world, isn't it, for investment to return ratio?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, what we need to do is to create social policies that promote wellness. And I mean wellness at the individual, the familial, the community, the national, the planetary level. And it can be done, and not only can it be done, but we can see in other countries that when they do it, it actually is cheaper and makes money. You know, just to take the illness profit system in the United States.
Which is called the healthcare system.
The healthcare system. But it's really an illness profit system. And in fact, you can see in exactly the areas you're talking about, that the extension of patent protection, that sort of thing. You can see that the function of the healthcare system is not to produce health, but to produce profit. I mean, if you realize that a child in rural North Carolina has about the same chance of surviving birth in the first year as a child born in Botswana, a woman living in Louisiana or Mississippi has 5 years less lifespan than a woman living in Oregon or Vermont, you can see that these, when you choose social policies whose only priority is profit, as opposed to choosing policies which promote wellness, that the the outcome of that is that degradation of the life of ordinary people. And that's what's happening in the United States. The middle class is being destroyed. You talk to anybody. We have 17 million children in the United States who experience hunger during the course of the year. We have 2.5 million homeless children. This is the richest country. Actually, China is now a larger economy than the United States, something else that doesn't get mentioned. But Joseph Stiglitz wrote a piece recently doing an analysis and the long-term implications of these policies that we have been pursuing, which are profit-oriented, and the degradation of the country, which is flowing out of that, really have long-term geopolitical consequences.
Again, I'm speaking with Stephen Schwartz, who is a distinguished consulting faculty at Saybrook University and a research associate of cognitive sciences at the Laboratories for Fundamental Research and the editor of the daily web publication SchwartzReport.net, where he identifies and analyzes trends that are affecting the future. His work has appeared in the Washington Post, Smithsonian, American Heritage, American History, Omni, Harper's, and Explore. And we're talking here in this new year, looking ahead to 2015 in terms of the challenges on the domestic front and trends, and that's what you do with SchwartzReport.net. You look in and identify and analyze trends that are affecting the future. What can break this divide where you've got conservatives in this country, you know, falling for the kind of divisive appeals that come out of this sense of the endangered white man and the minorities taking over? And I take it that the reason they support the candidates of the Koch brothers is that there's a certainty there, even though at the end of the day, they're going to get hosed and the Kochs are going to get richer. But on the other side, it seems that the reason that a lot of people didn't show up to vote on for the Democrats is it's simply the Democrats are not inspiring people. There's no message. There's no coherent. I mean, if they were to say, look, we wanted an America in which every child is, you know, the reverse of what you're just saying about all of the horrible statistics, particularly in some of the poorer southern states where we are, people, our fellow Americans are living in third world conditions. So what's preventing them from coming up with a manifesto that the American people could identify with it and support? Is it because they get their money from the same people that the Republicans get their money from?
The cowardice, I think, actually, not to put too fine a point on it. I mean, you can look at Elizabeth Warren, for instance, and the popularity that she evokes, or Bernie Sanders. I mean, you know, why is that? Why do people respond so viscerally? Why did people respond to Obama so viscerally in 2008? I mean, you know, that I'm sure you remember, you talked about it at the time, that kind of excitement that something new was going to happen. The failure of the Democratic Party to develop a wellness-oriented social program and to support it passionately is why Democrats are not voting, particularly younger people, because they just see it as Republican light, and so why vote for it? They have a sense of disempowerment. Also, there's something else that really ought to be discussed in terms of trends in 2015, and that is the rise of what I guess you would call the neuroscience of politics. There's a great deal of very high caliber medical research, neuroscience research going on now, showing that for instance, that about 27% of the population have overactive right amygdalas. That's a little gland about the size of an almond that's situated in your middle of your brain. And where in every species that has an amygdala, it has one function, that is fight or flight. It's when you're really in desperate straits, it kicks in. The problem is that rational thought stops. And so what you see, and what the Republicans have really mastered, because they really have paid close attention to this thing, is that you can manipulate people to vote against their own self-interest by creating fear. And if you spend an hour watching Fox News, for instance, I mean, it's you come away terrified. So there are so many things out to get you that that fear kicks in. And for a significant, just a little under a third of the population, it becomes the dispositive effect. And therefore, they vote for people that they think will relieve them of the fear, even though demonstrably the policies of the people they're voting for are against their own self-interest. So we need to get within the Democrat, within the social progressive, from a Democrat, those who care about wellness, and I hope as we begin the year 2015 that we, those of us who do care about wellness, really do come together and recognize that our involvement, our voting, our involvement in local social programs that help people, all of those things make a profound difference.
But the amygdala issue that you just cited, not even watching Fox News, but even watching the evening news on regular, like CBS, ABC, or NBC, it's a nightmare. It focuses on mayhem and aberrant social behavior.
Yes.
So what is the role of the media then? And is there any way that we could evolve a media that followed what you're talking about, this idea of their charter is to produce social wellness, not social anxiety?
Yes. Well, we have to convince people that it pays, because profit, in American society, profit is the only priority. If you can't make a profit, it doesn't matter how good inherently the thing is, it's not going to get a lot of support. We, as a country, need to start telling ourselves the truth. That's a good place to start. We need to acknowledge what we have done to our culture, what we are doing. You know, just to give you one example. During the 10 years of the Iraq-Afghanistan wars, about 5,783, somewhere in that number, close to that number, service personnel were killed in combat by IEDs or gunfire, whatever. During that same time, that same 10 years, 270,000 Americans were killed by other Americans with gunfire, about 26,000 people a year. We have this huge social epidemic, and yet you can see in a few weeks ago the appointing of the new Surgeon General, he had been held up in his appointment for over a year simply because he said we needed to think about guns as a health problem. Not that he had any specific recommendation or that he was opposed to people owning any of that, just simply that guns constitute a health issue in the United States. 26,000 people, that's more than get killed in almost all home accident incidents, cars. It's astonishing. It's a silent epidemic that is killing tens of thousands of people every year, and yet we don't even talk about it. In fact, corporate media almost never talks about any of the substantive issues, because the substantive issues require that people who are funding the media are going to get their profits are going to be hurt. But until we start talking about the real issues, the collapse of antibiotic medicine, for instance, as a result of the rise of industrial, chemical, monoculture, agriculture, and animal husbandry, we are seeing the rise of the superbugs. And a recent survey showed that over half the physicians who were surveyed had, in fact, had patients who had been seriously harmed by the rise or died by the rise of these superbugs that don't respond to antibiotics. We can see with the sea rise work that's going on. I mean, you know.
You mean as a result of global warming?
Yeah, as a result of global warming. And the thing that we're looking at is that the timeline is collapsing and the parameters of how bad it's going to get keep getting expanded. So when you look at within 50 years, a city like Miami may be uninhabitable, or that San Francisco is going to, by the end of the century, will be a series of islands, or that we're in Los Angeles Harbor is going to be broken up, or Baltimore or Norfolk or Washington, D.C. We're not talking about these things. We're not talking about the fact that we have now reached a place where alternative energies are at parity with carbon energies, and that a whole new model of energy, not just usage, but the infrastructure of energy usage needs to be developed. None of those kinds of conversations. Instead, we find out what Kim Kardashian, bless her heart, is doing, or is she somebody's taking a picture of her naked or whatever. That's the news. That isn't really the news. We are not dealing with the substantive issues. Everybody knows it. They feel it. They experience it in their own life. And so they become disaffected, distrustful, and ultimately they just tune out the political process. And a democracy can't operate like that.
Well, but surely the answer is that as to why it is that no progress has been made, although there was recently the Lima Accords, and they're going to have a meeting in Paris. But basically, even then, they're talking about not dealing with global warming until 2020 for these countries that are signing onto this new regime. It would seem to me that, you know, you and I and most sentient people on this planet, we have science, we have the facts, but on the other side, they have the money. And you were just saying earlier that this country runs on money, and if you don't make a profit, forget about it. So, you know, what do you do? Do you demonize oil companies? I mean, or do you maybe recruit insurance companies who have every reason to want to deal with global warming and its consequences because they're going to lose trillions of dollars?
Well, I can tell you, in fact, I've just written a book about this. It'll be published this coming fall. But I can tell you that something that is so simple, it's hard to take it seriously, but which can make a huge difference. I mean, first is vote. But in terms of who do I vote for, here is a way to change the world. Guaranteed, because it's been proven to work. Every time you're faced with a decision, whatever the decision is, and you make hundreds of these kinds of decisions every day, ask yourself, which is the most compassionate and life-affirming decision as you now understand it at that moment, and choose of the options available to you, choose the one that is the most compassionate and life-affirming. Now you say, well, I'm just an ordinary person. I mean, I make little decisions like, oh, I don't know what kind of car to drive or where to get my dry cleaning done. But just let me give you an example. My wife had a Saab station wagon, which she dearly loved, and we kept it going for many years, but it finally got to a place where it was dying. So we decided we would buy a new car, and we looked at all the various models of cars, and I wanted to get one. She wanted to get another one. We walked into we decided to go to the showroom, and we walked in and looked at the one I liked, and it said on the sticker on the window, 13 miles in the city, 17 miles in the highway. And I turned to her and said, we'll buy your car. We can't buy this car. And the guy came out and said, can I help you? And I said, no, you can't, because the car I want to buy only gets 13 miles in the city and 17 miles on the highway. And he said, yes. And I said, well, I can't drive a car like that. I don't even think it's ethical to make a car like that. And his response was, well, our clientele, because it was an expensive car, doesn't concern themselves with gas prices. And I said, this has nothing to do with gas prices. So we went down the street and we bought her car, which gets 34 miles to the gallon. If you make a choice, every time you are faced with a choice, if you choose to make the compassionate and life-affirming choice based on the options available to you, it doesn't have to be perfect. The perfect is not the enemy of the good. The best option that you've got. Now, you think that doesn't really make any difference, but let me give you an example of how powerful this can be. Look at the difference. It took about 6 months for gay to become LGBT. Suddenly, everybody that used to use the word gay was using the word LGBT. Now, how did that happen? It wasn't like they issued a memorandum that said, we will now use this. And it isn't just the change in the word. It was really a change in the concept. So how did that happen? And the answer is, it happened because millions of people made tiny little decisions that when they spoke or wrote that word, instead of saying gay, they said LGBT. You can see the same thing, and it took longer in smoking. When we take an 81 milligram aspirin, and most middle-aged men take 81 milligram aspirins, the actual effect that it produces is very small. It's quite a small effect, less than 5%. And yet, it's sufficiently impressive to physicians that they recommend to their male patients, particularly when they get into middle age, that they take an 81 milligram aspirin. Those little small choices in aggregate bring change. And that's the great secret that nobody wants to talk about, is that if we made different choices in our daily life and the kinds of things we buy, you can look at McDonald's, for instance. The decline in McDonald's income and profit because people are not buying fast food as much. Now they're going to Chipotle or someplace like that that has healthier food. If you look at there was a story recently about the decline in the McDonald's profits. Why? Because people said, let's go out to dinner. Oh, do you want to go to McDonald's? No. Let's go down to the Chipotle place. So it's those thousands and thousands and thousands and millions of decisions, choosing the more life-affirming version of whatever choice is, that really produce long-term social change. And also, when you vote, there may be no perfect candidate, but there is a candidate who is better in terms of their commitment to wellness than the other candidate. And if you always make the compassionate, life-affirming choice, and if millions of us do that, and we actually know how many people we have to do it, because research has been done on this. It shows that when 10% of any cohort decide to make a certain kind of choice, that the whole cohort tips, the gestalt of the whole cohort tips. So just in terms of voters, people of voting age, we need to get about 10% who will pick, of the options available, the most compassionate and life-affirming choice. And if we will do that and actually vote, we can reclaim our country. If we don't, we are doomed.
We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back continuing the conversation with Stephen Schwartz. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and we're continuing the conversation here on this New Year's holiday with Stephen Schwartz, a distinguished consulting faculty at Saybrook University and a research associate of cognitive sciences at the Laboratories for Fundamental Research, and the editor of the daily web publication SchwartzReport.net, where he identifies and analyzes trends that are affecting the future. His work has appeared in The Washington Post, Smithsonian, American Heritage, American History, Omni, Harpers, and Explore. So as we enter 2015, in terms of our discussion on domestic challenges, of course, 2015, leading up to 2016, it's going to be another horse race, endless amounts of money, endless amounts of media time, basically coming down to whether it's going to be Hillary or Jeb, a Clinton or a Bush. That would seem to be a fairly safe prognosis. You know, one of the tragedies, I think, of the Obama administration has been that, first of all, he's been so vilified by the right that Fox News and others have given a lot of Americans permission to hate this man in the most irrational and unreasonable way. And it's metastasized into a very toxic kind of polity. But on the other side, on the political left, they're almost as angry at Obama as the derangement syndrome on the political right. And most of it is like he wasn't tough enough, he didn't stand up, he didn't do this, he didn't do that, he wasn't the miracle worker, etc. But I think in a way, what the real tragedy here is that this was a man who was genuinely bipartisan. He really, you know, I talked to people that knew him at Harvard, and he would go off on these long weekend seminars, you know, where they would, you know, the head of the Christian Coalition would be sitting next to the head of a labor union, and that they would sort of, you know, have these long dialogues and debates and try to come to some consensus. And that, I think, was the vision that he has. Remember, many times he said, there aren't any red states and blue states, there's only the United States. I mean, he said that even back in that famous speech he made to the Democratic Convention. So does that strike you as you know, one, a tragedy, and two, where we really need to put our focus on, you know, trying to heal these divisions, this artificial line, even though demographically it's all clear? If you look at the last election, almost every Democratic vote came from an urban, concentrated urban area, where Democrats tend to have to compete against other Democrats. And then the rest of the country, the red states, are all rural, and that gives them an electoral advantage, which will mean that the Republicans will probably control the House for a long time and most maybe the Senate. So when we talk about 2016 coming up, you know, at the end of the day, if the Democrats, that's the only branch of the government they can win, is the executive.
Yeah.
And frankly, if, you know, the Supreme Court itself, the legislative branch, is just one seat away from becoming the most reactionary court imaginable, that, you know, will take us back to the, you know, God knows, to the witch-burning era.
Well, I mean, the truth is, again, we need to tell ourselves the truth. And the truth is, we're a day late and a dollar short. We are in desperate straits. I research trends all day long. It's one of the things I do. And I wish I could tell you that I saw lots of positive trends. I do see a few, the rise of localism, the rise of locally produced food, that sort of thing. I mean, I do see some things. But all of the big trends, we are an empire in decline. And I think we also need to recognize one of the things that I think has driven the business with Obama is that for the first time in 500 years, essentially the entirety of American history, and in a way, for the first time in really almost 1,000 years, being born white is not going to confer privilege. And the European, North American cultural model is no longer going to be dispositive. China's the largest economy. India's coming right along. These countries have their own cultural view and their own cultural approach. And it's going to cause and is causing enormous anxiety. I mean, the fact that, I mean, it doesn't bother you. You're a social progressive. It doesn't bother me. I'm a social progressive. I don't mean Democrat, Republican. I mean a person who supports wellness-oriented social programs. So to us, it seems sort of, all right, well, that's just what's happening. But to a great number of people, particularly older whites, the idea that just being born white is not going to give you privilege is incredibly anxiety-producing. That's what's really behind the election of Obama. You know, that it was the first step in this process of becoming a majority-minority country. That's why you see this voter suppression, the gerrymandering, the packing all the people of color into little districts. And all of that is designed to protect white privilege. It isn't going to work. I mean, from my perspective, looking at the trends, I think we are going to change. We are going to have to change. Climate change is simply going to compel us to change. So it's not a question of are we going to change. It's a question of how much pain we're going to inflict, because all of this is self-inflicted, how much pain we're going to inflict on ourselves before we wake up to the fact that those countries which assimilate minorities, those countries which provide gender equality, those countries which produce wellness-oriented social policies. And you can look at countries like Norway, for instance, or much of Scandinavia, or in terms of healthcare, France, are doing much better. They spend less money. We spend more than any other country in the world on our illness profit system, and we get dreadful results. America has the best healthcare system in the world. You hear every politician say it, and it's true if you have unlimited money. But if you're an ordinary person, that is not true. It just simply isn't true. You can look at the outcome results. So we have to get to a place where, A, we tell ourselves the truth about what's really going on, which is very painful, and B, that we make a decision that as a country, we are going to support wellness, the pursuit of happiness. The founders all understood this. I mean, the thing about the founders that we don't hear about, particularly from the conservative side, is that, for instance, just church and state, all of these men, either in their own personal lives or in the lives of their parents or grandparents, had a direct experience of what happens when the church and the state are one. And they understood it's a bad system. And they very carefully created a firewall between church and state. They in the Treaty of Tripoli, they again reiterated it. This is not a Christian country. In fact, it's not an anything country. It's not a country founded on a religion. And yet we have, you know, Rick Santorum. It's a communist idea to have a separation of church and state. I mean, it's just amazing stuff. We have to get back really to the fundamental principles, which was the pursuit of happiness. It's Benjamin Franklin. Franklin saw the United States as being a essentially middle class, upwardly mobile, entrepreneurial, technologically sophisticated culture, family-centered, humorous, indulgent, and inclusive. That's the world that he saw and sought to create. That's why he created the first insurance companies, the first hospitals, the first sanitation programs, libraries. That's why he invented micro-lending. I mean, the Grameen Bank is a 200-year later recreation of Franklin's original creation of his trusts, which, as you and I are sitting here in the beginning of 2015, about 3,500 kids are going to college, mostly children of color and of low income, basically financed by Benjamin Franklin. That's how strongly he felt about this. So if
you mean the trust has lasted that long and it's still throwing out money?
He made a codicil in his will in 1789. And he gave money to Philadelphia and to Boston as a trust to be loaned to married apprentices of good character who had older people who would stand surety for them to be loaned at interest. Small loans, exactly what Kiva and Grameen Bank did, same thing. He said it's to run for 100 years. At the end of 100 years, he appointed a committee Think about this. Think about it. He's sitting under a mulberry tree in 1789. He knows he's dying, and he amends his will. He's the most famous man in the world at this point. And he says, and it runs for 100 years. And at the end of 100 years, I appoint a committee, and he names who's going to be on the committee, not by name, but by job position. And they can reassess keeping my intention. And then it's going to run for another 100 years, and I can't see past 200 years. So on the second century anniversary, I appoint another committee, and they can decide what to do, and I ask them only to honor my principles. So he died in 1790. In 1890, his heirs, through his daughter Sally, challenged the trust, saying that no individual could have a private trust. And the court ruled, and then they appealed, and they ruled against him a second time. And those two decisions are the legal basis for all the philanthropy in the United States. In 1890, they opened it up to women apprentices, because in 1790, they didn't have women apprentices. And in 1990, there were $6.5 million in the trusts, and they were dispersed to the two colleges that had been created in the 1890 realignment. And so as we sit here, there are children going to college financed by a man sitting under a mulberry tree in 1789.
We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back continuing the conversation with Stephen Schwartz. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and we're continuing the conversation with Stephen Schwartz, a distinguished consulting faculty at Saybrook University and a research associate of cognitive sciences at the Laboratories for Fundamental Research and the editor of the daily web publication SchwartzReport.net, where he identifies and analyzes trends that are affecting the future. His work has appeared in The Washington Post, Smithsonian, American Heritage, American History, Omni, Harper's, and Explore. So on this New Year's holiday, as we look ahead at 2015 and particularly at the domestic political challenges ahead, you mentioned earlier about some of the hopeful things, food banks, local farmers markets, local agriculture. Just to broaden it out a little bit, one of the great tragedies that I see in the way the world is heading is the extermination of the vast numbers of species and the differences and the diversity of plant and animal life, where the white rhinos had just become extinct. And then you've got these horrible people like the so-called Islamic State, which I hate using that word because the Arabs call it Daesh, which is the acronym, and they don't dignify the idea that these people have anything to do with Islam. And I think you were talking earlier about having more precise terms, and that's one that we should really... you talked about the LGBT thing happening. The one thing we should do is eliminate that word Islamic from any association with people like the so-called Islamic State and call them Daesh. But what they're doing and what's happened in Pakistan and other countries is they're exterminating these little religious minorities. And in Syria, for example, these little villages where they still speak Aramaic are being overrun by these al-Nusra and al-Qaeda types. And this is the language of Jesus Christ from the days of the Bible. So is there a way that we can sort of start reverse things away from the homogenization of life to celebrate and encourage diversity?
Yes, well, we make different choices. One of the meta trends that's going on, which doesn't get much coverage, in the Middle East, that's flowing out of these dreadful decisions to start these wars. And I mean, from my point of view, the fundamentalist jihadists were created by the Iraq War. These are people who, angry people who, as a result of those invasions, have risen to power. But one of the things that's going on over there, and I lived in Egypt for 2 years, is the decline and eventual extinction of the Christian tradition in the Middle East and the Jewish tradition. I mean, these were peoples that lived together for hundreds and hundreds of years. And yet you look at the Copts in Egypt who feel that they're under threat now, or the complete in Syria. I mean, the communities that have been there since the beginning of the Christian era are now being destroyed, just as you say. And the long-term implications of that are quite extraordinary. If we had spent the 2.4, I mean, to pick a number, a trillion that we've poured into these wars. I mean, I've heard all kinds of numbers, but the number really doesn't matter. It's a very large number. If we had poured that money into building libraries, in building schools, in building medical facilities, we would be looked at in the same way that we were looked at in Europe after the end of the Marshall Plan. It's one of the great geopolitical disasters that the lessons of the Marshall Plan were not carried over into the Middle East, and for that matter, into Russia. I mean, there was a moment in Russia, the only person that got it, at the billionaire group, was George Soros, who understood that if they had stepped in, and he tried to, but he just wasn't big enough, if they had stepped in and provided the educational material, the support materials. You know, when I lived in Egypt during the Carter administration, the most popular place in Cairo to be and to be seen, if you were a young, educated Egyptian, was at the USIA libraries. We had these libraries all over the world where you
That's the U.S. Information Agency.
U.S. Information Agency, yes, excuse me. Where you could get American magazines and see American television shows and movies and things. And these libraries were where all of these young people gathered and were drawing their ideas about how the world ought to be ordered. And then Reagan closed them all down. And in that decision was a terrible mistake, because they were replaced with madrasas and radical jihadists, we'll just call them. I mean, I agree with you about the words. We simply are not trying to produce wellness. We're trying to produce profit. So if nothing else would happen and we could wave a magic wand, you and I, sitting in the studio at KPFK, and make something happen, it would be that the social policies of the United States, both national and international, were oriented to create wellness. Because wellness will also create enormous profit. Every time there is a major technological shift, great fortunes were made. I mean, you think about it for a minute. A group of post-adolescent IT nerds became billionaires because of the computer information. Before that, the Rockefellers and people like them made vast fortunes on the conversion from coal and steam to petroleum. And before that, the conversion from sail to powered ships. So there's vast – it's not that you can't make profit within wellness. The question is how – if you make wellness the first priority – then you can make profit the second priority, and you figure out how to make profit within a wellness-oriented system. And clearly it can be done, and clearly it has been done. And so if we could wave a magic wand here, I would ask that we make choices individually that are compassionate and life-affirming. We make that choice of that option, and that socially that our country go back to what it did when Roosevelt was president, and that is, and even Truman afterwards, and George Marshall, that we create wellness. Because if we do that, America will prosper and we'll be the city on a shining hill. If we don't do that, it's going to be very bleak.
But can we make changes at the cultural level to address some of the things that you've brought up in this interview so far? You talked about the extraordinary number of people who die every year, 26,000 from gun violence, you know, and compared to the deaths in the Iraq War, it's an extraordinary and alarming statistic. How many people have died in this country? Hundreds of thousands just during the Iraq War itself, those years. And also the other great challenge that we're facing is the growing income disparity as the wealthy get wealthier and own more and more of our politics and buy our politicians and get their way. And, you know, the pie is shrinking for the rest of us. But it would seem to me that both of these issues could be tackled at the cultural level. If as a culture we didn't sanction guns as instruments of that solve problems. Like every movie, you know, the problem is solved by the use of a gun. If our young boys and girls grew up in a culture where to use a gun or to have a gun is a shameful thing, that is it's an absolute instrument of shame and an instrument of cowardice. And at a cultural level, if we could not so much, you know, sanction billionaires, but certainly not celebrate greed and the senseless accumulation of wealth.
Mm-hmm. Well, if we could do that, then we would have a wellness-oriented society and we would become a healthy country again. We are an unhealthy country. Our infrastructure is falling apart. You know, Americans think they are the most advanced country in the world. Trust me, anybody who has gone overseas to Seoul or Tokyo or Singapore or Hong Kong or whole sections of China, you realize, or Turkey, I mean, the quality of the transportation, the quality of the internet, the speed of the internet, the coverage of the mobile phones, the quality of the bridges. If we would stop spending money for things which produce death and instead focus on creating things which produce wellness, we could resolve this. This is not undoable. The problem is, I think ultimately, is that we have a very short window before the system locks up, just as you describe. I mean, we both know that 2015 and leading up to the election of 2016, it's very unlikely that anything meaningful is going to come out of the Congress. It's also clear that because of gerrymandering and voter suppression and the approval of voter suppression by certain courts, that very soon the Republicans are going to have a lock on the House. It'll be impossible really to displace them. So because all funding bills begin in the House, we are going to face a problem that can't be solved. We have a short window, maybe 5-10 years maximum, in which we're either going to choose to make different choices, or the world that our children and our grandchildren, and more I think about that. I have a 2.5-year-old grandson and another one coming, and I look at those kids and I think, what is the world that they live in going to look like? Well, we now know that the climate change temperature tip point is going to be within the next decade. That's the latest thing. We know that seafood is probably going to disappear by 2048. That's the latest study. What is that world they're going to look at? By the end of the century, that great cities, 52% of the American population live within 100 miles of a seacoast or at an elevation of less than 30 feet, and those areas are going to be flooded in large measure. Cities like Miami and are going to disappear or largely disappear. What is that world that they're going to live in? I think we each individually, and this is, you know, we're at the new year, so this is a time to do it. We need to make a new year's resolution that this year I am going to support wellness in every way I can. And if we do that, we have a chance. If we don't do it, very soon we will be locked up in a way that it will be awfully difficult to change. And the world that those children will inherit will be so different from the world we live in that it's almost unimaginable.
Well, when you look at the specter of global warming and how we're running out of time and it exponentially gets worse as we delay the necessary action now, it is despairing. But I guess the hope that I have is, since I worked in nuclear weapons and nuclear weapons disarmament during the Cold War, as you did as well, that, you know, it was equally despairing. The stupidity of these two superpowers pointing these missiles at each other and promising death to the world within half an hour, and this constant hair trigger and the conundrum that the more that you nuclear weapons that you built and the more money you spent on so-called defense, the less secure you became. And we were in that trap, and then almost miraculously, it all went away. I mean, the weapons haven't gone away, and you got some, you know, dangerous people like Putin with his finger on the button. But in general, it's been a massive change. So is it possible that a change like that could also take place in terms of our understanding of global warming? In other words, we could sort of suddenly engender a kind of global patriotism where we all realize we're all in the same boat here and we better start bailing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It could be done. That's a wonderful analogy, in fact, that you pick. We went from mutually assured destruction and it disappeared, like a bad fog. Can it happen? Absolutely. The 2016 election is going to be a dispositive election about our future. It's going to cast the lot of a generation. And between now and the next 2 years, when we come to this election, if we make different choices, absolutely, we could have a different world.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us on this New Year's holiday, Stephen Schwartz.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Schwartz, who's a distinguished consulting faculty at Saybrook University and a research associate of cognitive sciences at the Laboratories for Fundamental Research, and the editor of the daily web publication SchwartzReport.net, where he identifies and analyzes trends that are affecting the future. His work has appeared in the Washington Post, Smithsonian, American Heritage, American History, Omni, Harper's, and Explore. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down to the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. In the meantime, have a happy new year. Whoa.